welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 25th of October 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week in glorious Blighty, and that means we are here today with my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring to discuss the past week's news, but we haven't had much news last week, so most of the first half of the episode will be to do with Ridley Road, and of course the second half will be our great East Britons. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed, thank you. I've had some good news today, which is that I'm going to be become a grandfather again.
again. Oh, that's fantastic news, Max. Congratulations. Well done. How many grandchildren do you have now?
Well, that once this one arrives, that will be six.
Excellent stuff.
Still got some way to go.
Excellent stuff. You got a whole tribe of grandchildren there. You lucky man. It must make you really pleased and chuffed to bits to see them when they're all young and sort of playing around at that age, and to think you've got, you know, two generations there that you've sired. You must be very proud of yourself and your family.
Well, I'm very proud of my family. Yes. It's fairly easy from my point of view, producing them, to be quite honest. It was more raising them that's the difficult part.
Well, I'm surprised you managed to actually find time to watch the rest of the Ridley Road series, if you've been had all that excitement going on. But you tell me that you have. I haven't actually seen the rest of it, but I am aware of what went on at that time, obviously, and we've talked about episode one in Ridley Road two episodes back. So do you want to sort of run through what happened in the rest of the series and what your thoughts are on it, Max?
Yeah, the Ridley Road episode that we saw, when we last spoke about it, we spoke about episode one. I then went online and binge watched the other three episodes so that I'd sort of seen the whole thing. And the main findings that I have from watching it are firstly that it's very comic book in the way that it's the cinematography, a lot of the dialogue is really, really corny and comic book in the way that it's presented. Also, a number of the characters are very comic book in terms of their style, and so Françoise Dior is portrayed as being a very comic book kind of female archetypal sort of evil witch kind of woman, and Norman Rockwell is portrayed, you might have thought if you just turned on halfway through the program that you were watching Batman and it was the Joker or something like that. You know, his character is so wooden, it's just unbelievable. But the story features around the struggle between the 62 group, the Jewish 62 group that existed during the 1960s, and the National Socialist movement that was started by Colin Jordan. The program is presented as if it is real, despite the fact that it says inspired by real events. You know, it is docudrama, so it is a blending of fact and fiction together. And I would say that there is probably a fair bit more fiction than there is fact. But the way in which the fact and fiction are woven together makes it apparent that there is an attempt on the part of the producers of this program and the writer of the book, etc., to justify Jewish hostility toward nationalists, which is what one would expect, but also to justify Jewish suspicion on a wider scale of the motivations of non-Jews, and I'll sort of come back to that. And I think that that is the case because of the disproportionate, the fact that the program has been produced in a way which is disproportionately one-sided. And if we look at the people involved in the production of the program, it becomes apparent why that is, because the author of the original book is a lady by the name of Jo Bloom. I think when we spoke about it last time, I hadn't found any concrete reference from her confirming that she is Jewish. But in fact, it turns out that she is Jewish, and she mentions about how the chaplain for the 62 group, who was a rabbi, married her parents, and so that's fairly conclusive then that she's of Jewish ancestry. She then mentions the fact that her mother was best friends with the mother of Steve Silver, who was a writer for Searchlight magazine, and that as a result of that friendship between her mother and Steve Silver's mother, Steve Silver then volunteered to provide her with lots of research material that had been collected together by Searchlight. And so it's becoming clearer why the program is very one-sided. Then we have the screenwriter who adapted the book for television, who is Sarah Soleimani, who is stated as being Jewish in the various articles that I've written. Joe Bloom and Sarah Soleimani worked together with another executive producer, I think she's called Nicola Schindler. Now, I don't know whether Nicola Schindler is Jewish, but I would think with a name like that, it is a possibility. And then the leading actress in the program is Agnes O'Casey, who, if you look her up on Wikipedia, it states there that her original name is Agnes Koenig, and that she has a Jewish grandfather. And so there's a very sort of dense Jewishness about the people who've been responsible for the production of the program, and of course a number of other key characters in the program are Jewish actors playing Jewish parts as well. And what happens is in the program that Vivian decides to she's in love with her sort of childhood sweetheart, a guy called Jack. Jack then disappears from her life. She then discovers that he's working in London, and so she sets off to London to track him down to find out why he's kind of deserted her, in the hopes of winning him back. She then travels to London. When she gets to London, she's taken then to an empty railway carriage in a railway siding, where she has a conversation with Jack there. And Jack then confesses to her that he is working as a mole on behalf of the 62 group, and that he has infiltrated the National Socialist Movement, and that he is passing information to the 62 group in order to frustrate the National Socialist Movement's plans. And in that particular scene, in that railway carriage, he says, I can pass, can't I? I.e. pass as a non-Jew, because in the program, he is supposedly a Jew who just doesn't look very Jewish. I don't know whether the actor that plays Jack is Jewish or not, but that's beside the point. But he says, I can pass, can't I? And when you can pass, they let you in. That's how their minds work. Not just Colin Jordan and his NSM Nazis, but regular people, teachers, blokes down the pub. You can see the disgust, the rage, the way they sigh or wish something could be done. The endless Jewish question with only one answer. And to me, that is a very significant speech that he makes there in that particular episode.
That was a quote there, was it? That was a quote there, was it, Max? That was, you yeah, were that, quoting
that,
him
that,
there,
that
yeah?
That was a direct quote where he's effectively saying that he's inferring that there is a need not only for Jews to be suspicious of the actions of nationalist organizations or the nationalist socialist movement that existed at that time, but there is a need for Jews to be suspicious of the motivations and the thoughts and the way in which they're regarded by the wider non-Jewish population, basically. And so it's to some extent, casting a shadow over the over non-Jews and saying that as far as Jews are concerned, we should all be to some extent suspect, and that they should be watchful and wary of us, just because. And the implication is that whenever the Jewish question arises, that it that only one answer occurs to us, which obviously it's inferred is going to be a sort of hostile or homicidal kind of solution that springs to mind, which, you know, it obviously isn't the case. And this indicates that the hatred with which the 62 group regarded the National Socialists in those days differs only in degree to the suspicion and paranoia they would like non-Jews to harbour, sorry, they would like Jews to harbour with regard to non-Jews. And so that's a very negative theme as far as the program is concerned.
Can I just add something there, Max? Can I just add something there? I mean, just briefly. I mean, this sort of plays in with what I observe. It seems to me that the Jews are a very paranoid people. They're very timid. They're very concerned about what people think of them. That's why they have all these polls to do with anti-Semitism. And looking at it from their point of view, they think, well, we've been pogromed all these times. We have to, you know, we have to watch these Gentiles. And this is the problem with multiculturalism, isn't it? You know, they feel that they are persecuted by us and they have to constantly watch us and they have to constantly be careful. And we feel as if their ways are very different to ours and they can end up weakening our nation. And all of that would just be solved if we didn't have multiculturalism. You know, when you look at it from the Jewish point of view, that they feel that they have an absolute right to be thinking like that. And they cannot understand why we don't understand it. It's all the problems that are caused by multiculturalism. So that's the way that I would look at that. And I just wanted to put across that balancing viewpoint, you know, just to sort of point out the way that the Jew would see it.
Oh, yeah. And you know, one of the main themes that I push on a regular basis is that it's the internal dynamics of multiculturalism that causes people to be to view other ethnic groups with rivalry, and that is the cause rather of inter-ethnic strife, and that's exactly the same. You know, this TV program kind of supports that viewpoint, and there is a character in the program called Solly Malinowski, who is a fictional person. He is actually the Solly Malinowski character plays the role of who would have been in real life Harry Bidney, who was the person who was running and who founded the 62 group. And during one of the scenes in the program, the question is whether or not it's that they need to do anything at this stage, because you know there isn't that great a threat at all from anybody yet. And Solly Malinowski says, and this is again a quotation: "Everything seems fine until the moment it ain't, but then it's too late." And so it's. And they're basically saying that even though things seem fine, even though relations between you and non-Jews appear to be okay, you still need to be suspicious and watchful, because everything seems fine until the moment it ain't, but then it's too late. And so that's, as I say, that's like another element within this negative theme that's running through this program, which I think is it's quite sad, really, that exists. But again, you see, when Vivian leaves Manchester, because that's where in the program she originates, when she leaves London to go, or so leaves Manchester to go to London, she is advised by her cousin, who's a character called Rosa Furstenberg, who apparently survived the Holocaust and who is very kind of paranoid as a result of surviving the Holocaust. And she tells Vivian not to use the name Epstein, but to use the name Evans instead. And she says, "Don't let anyone know you're Jewish." So again, this, you know, this is a theme which is running through a considerable part of this program. Another thing which I thought was quite interesting was the fact that in the premises of this Solly Malinowski character, they are they're having a meeting, and then there's a knock at the door, and Solly Malinowski turns around to his son, who's called Ronnie in the program, and says that this had better not be another one of your shiksas. And to use the term shiksa, I thought was very strange in view of the fact that, you know, using the N-word and using terms of racial abuse is generally frowned upon, even when it's being done, when it's committed in an innocuous context. It's still regarded as beyond the pale. And the word shiksa basically means a Gentile tart or trollop, and it's a term of disrespect used by Jews to describe the Gentile women that some Jews have relationships with. So again, that's a surprising thing as far as this television program was concerned. And It's also interesting in that initially when the program starts, it appears as though Vivian's family in Manchester have got nothing to do with the 62 group and nothing to do with what's going on in London. But as the program progresses, it becomes apparent that this Solly Malinowski character is the brother of Vivian's mother. And that far from being a civilian, in inverted commas, as far as the struggle between the 62 group and the National Socialist Movement is concerned, it turns out that Vivian's father is a document forger and a trainer of moles. And he says in one of these particular scenes, for 20 years, I've been training infiltrators. It takes months, sometimes years, for an individual to be assessed, to be prepared to allow you to set foot amongst these fascists. And so again, what it's telling you is that there are individuals within the Jewish community who are spending 20 years training people just to be infiltrators. And so it's often been claimed by nationalist movements that the people who actually do things that discredit them were actually moles that were infiltrated into the organization. And it's very often believed that these moles are infiltrated into nationalist organizations to deliberately defame them by committing heinous acts. This program kind of supports the fact that there are such moles being trained by Jewish people. And the research that was done for this program was done by Joe Bloom and Sarah Soleimani, and together with Steve Silver. And so you have to accept that, you know, from the there is going to be a fair bit of truth in these things that they portray in the film. And so it's surprising that they are presenting these kind of things in this program as the truth. And then there was a scene which I thought was a really interesting scene, which was in episode 3, which is where the Vivian's father prevails upon Solly Malinowski to go to Special Branch Festival and not to actually resort to violence themselves initially. And they go to see Special Branch. And they tell Special Branch that they have planted a bug in the headquarters of the National Socialist Movement, which they have as far as the film is concerned, and that they've got a lot of they've got recordings of things that are being said, where the National Socialists are speaking in an impolite, irreverent, and insulting way about the Jews, and the police officer says, well, we can't be doing anything in this. He says, and the police officer says in the program, quote, in this country, we practice freedom of speech. If these tapes had any evidence of violence or weapons, but a bit of bad language, what kind of a country would this be if we locked people up for saying things we didn't like? Can you imagine that? I mean, the sort of barefaced cheek of sticking a line like that in a program, when, of course, all sorts of ethnic minority organizations and there are a fair number of Jewish organizations spend their time campaigning for people to be locked up just for that, for saying things that they don't like.
I think that was part of the rationale for producing this, wasn't it? I read in one of the interviews they really wanted to show how shocking it was that in the Britain of 40 years ago we didn't have these laws that prevented us from using racial slurs and how awful that was. So part of the reasoning for actually making that was to try and portray how terrible it was that that scene happened, and that they were able to record the National Socialist Movement speaking impolitely, and yet the police did nothing about it. I mean, the non-Jewish watchers of that scene are supposed to be absolutely infuriated that the police did nothing about it, Max, from what I've read in the interview.
I can imagine that. So, but it just made me laugh when I, the sort of irony of that line being in this actual program. Much of the dialogue, though, and as I said earlier on, the cinematography is unintentionally comic book in style and content. And so we have a scene in episode one where Vivian begins the process of infiltrating into the National Socialist Movement. And in this scene, she goes and knocks on the front door of there, where which is then answered by one of the National Socialist guys. And he's sort of asking her what she wants. And he's a little bit suspicious about what she's up to. But anyway, she insists that she'd like to come in because she wants to speak to somebody in there. And in order to allay his fears, she comes out with this line, which is all for the folk and the folk for all, as if, you know, this is the way that people actually speak in nationalist organizations. And then when that doesn't sort of really work, because this bloke just frowns and looks at her as if she's got a screw loose, and then she leans forward in a slightly hushed voice. She says, "Perish Judah." As if, bizarre. Again, as if that's the sort of thing, you know, the type of conversation that people would have in a nationalist organization. It just makes you laugh, really.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it is bizarre. It does, you know, it sounds as if they have, you know, that they have got some elements of truth in there. And I'm surprised that they're actually putting in, you know, the fact that they do put all this work into putting these moles into these organizations. And I'm interested that I don't see why they portray George Lincoln Rockwell as so wooden, but the idea of it being like a sort of Batman, like the 50s, 60s Batman series. I mean, that is sort of how I imagined it, to be. I mean, it doesn't sound that bad so far, to be honest. But I think also maybe it's a bit like the British version of the American series Hunter, which was about Jews hunting down former Nazis and then killing them extrajudicially. And the whole point of that was to promote this idea that it's okay for Jews to call somebody a Nazi and then kill them because they are a Nazi. And it was sort of justifying that. And I'm sort of seeing this program as a sort of British version of that. That's maybe a little bit tamer because we don't have weapons here, but it's saying, you know, if people are using impolite language for Jews, then they should be shut down. They should be locked up because it can lead to terrible things happening. That I think that's the message.
Well, I would say this program isn't anywhere near as severe as that American program that you're sort of mentioning. It's unintentionally comic book. It's not done with the intention of making it appear like a kind of comic book story. It is, you know, quite obviously unintentional. In one of the episodes as well, you know, typically there's the actor playing the part of Colin Jordan, and he then has a number of scenes where he's talking to Vivian as she's trying to infiltrate the organization. And of course, he has to fall in love with her, you see. And so there's this one scene where he looks at her and says, "You have the most intelligent eyes I've ever seen, just like my mother." Which it seems a bit bizarre because the actress concerned is, as I've already stated, of partially Jewish descent, and in my view looks like that would be the case. And so I would imagine that if Colin Jordan was as obsessed about Jews as this program tends to make out, that he would have been far keener in terms of looking for signs that this girl wasn't like his mother. But then later on in the episode, again, this is like even more kind of which portraying Colin Jordan as having a really kind of soppy schoolboy crush on this girl. He says to her on one occasion when they just have to sort of meet on a landing in the in his house, I think it is, he said, "It's long been a dream. How can I put it? Not a dream, but a desire to sit up all night talking politics with a beautiful young woman." You know, as if this was his top chat up line. This is how he sort of intended to get her into bed. It was just so ridiculous. I burst out laughing actually when I saw that particular scene. And he says, "But I do want you to talk with me, to sit with me, to be with me."
Sounds so cheesy. It sounds like they really didn't miss up any chance to sort of smear Colin Jordan or to belittle Colin Jordan, really.
the smack. And then in another scene in episode three, which features the character of Françoise Dior. Françoise Dior is Dior is portrayed as being this really sort of Cruella de Vil kind of character, and she immediately suspects that Colin Jordan has got designs on young Vivian, you see. And so when young Vivian sort of comes into the room and is standing close to her, Françoise Dior leans forward and grabs the Vivian character by the crotch, which very is just, you know, really, really bizarre. And so, and then she turns to Colin Jordan, she says, "She has your mother's eyes, Colin. Be careful you don't fall in love."
It also sounds a bit like maybe it's like this projection as well. Maybe they don't have that many spies in amongst nationalists if this is the way they sort of think that nationalists behave. I mean, it seems to me as if the author that actually wrote the book is sort of imagining how nationalists would be, how these anti-Jewish people would be and how they would talk. And then she's sort of projecting it onto the characters, and the characters themselves are coming across as, well, as you say, unintentionally comic book because of it. So maybe there wasn't so much that was actually taken from actually having these spies there. I guess if they were taking it from Searchlight, which is the equivalent of Hope Not Hate, then their information would be the equivalent of what's on the Hope Not Hate blog, which is completely puerile. So I guess that would explain it.
Yeah, and then with the Françoise Dior character again, there's another scene a bit later on in the series where she says, "Is there any sound more satisfying than the squeal of a Jewish child?" Which again is just like so off the wall, and you know, it's not the sort of thing any rational person's going to say. Anybody who wants to be regarded as rational by anybody else would say, which again, amazing. And then the Norman Rockwell character comes into it towards the end of the series, and he effectively tries to, well, it appears sometimes like he's trying to wind up the Colin Jordan character. Provokes a street fight at the point where Colin Jordan has been goaded by him to stand outside a synagogue and make a speech, an anti-Jewish speech. But then, as I say, Norman Rockwell arranges for these NSM thugs to turn up with baseball bats and things, and then the 62 group turn up, and there's like an almighty street battle outside. But this comic book Norman Rockwell character is standing there sort of almost like the Penguin out of Batman, going, "Wah, ha, 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 ha," with his, I think he's got either a big cigar stuck in his mouth or he's got a cigarette and a long cigarette holder or whatever. But then is confronted suddenly by this mixed race character in the film, and he's so shocked, so sort of surprised by this chap popping up in front of him that he staggers backwards and falls over, and then apparently can't get up, and which again is just comic book and just like something that would happen to the Penguin in an episode of Batman. So it's there are elements of this that are just absolutely laughable.
I just have to point out there as well that that's a complete fantasy about George Lincoln Rockwell getting them into a fight, because I mean, he was smuggled in through Northern Ireland and they had to keep him hidden, and then he appeared at the camp, and then the police took him in and he spent some time talking to the police before he was then deported, because they had advertised that they were going to have him there, I think, and the government had said, he's completely banned. And the big news was that they had managed to smuggle him in through Northern Ireland. So there was no fighting that George Lincoln Rockwell was involved in. That was a complete fantasy, just put in there to smear George Lincoln Rockwell, really, and smear Jordan, I would say.
Yeah. But then there are attempts to use dialogue to link what happened in the 60s to more recent times, because as far as I'm aware, the slogan to "Get Our Country Back" is a slogan that's only been used by nationalist groups and possibly UKIP and the pro-Brexit groups over the last 5 years or so. I don't remember anybody using that term, "We're going to take our country back, we're going to get our country back." But that particular phrase is used at least three times in the series, which to me appears to be sort of completely out of time, in the sense that, you know, that phrase wasn't in nationalist parlance in those days.
Britain Awake was the one that Colin Jordan was famous for, and also saying Hitler was right. Apparently he was the first person to say that, and he said that on stage at Trafalgar Square, and then it was painted up on a bridge somewhere, and he started this catchphrase. But the main thing that was associated with the National Socialist Movement and the British movement after that was Britain Awake. That was the phrase that they always used. Not taking our country back. Yeah, that's a Brexit phrase, isn't it? That's from leaving the EU. So all the Brexiteers are now national socialists, are they? Is that what they're implying here?
Well, that's what I think. I can't think of any reason why that phrase would have been used as often as it has been at sort of key points in the program, unless there was a desire on somebody's part to try and create a verbal connection, a syntax connection. I can't quite think how you describe it technically between the past and the future and the more recent past.
It was the EU. It was leaving the EU. So they're effectively saying that all the Brexiteers are Nazis by using that phrase, taking our country back. I mean, Boris Johnson was using that. So it's implying he's a Nazi, isn't it, really?
That would be the case. That's right. So then there's the scene outside a synagogue where George Rockwell has goaded Colin Jordan into having this demonstration outside this synagogue and making this speech. And there are only two places in the film where Colin Jordan makes a speech, and in both cases, these are again really comic book stuff where he's saying things. And the audience that are listening to what he's saying are just reacting in a ludicrously enthusiastic manner, you know, to the point where you would think that they were perhaps slightly deranged. And obviously that's what the intention is. But there's the content of the speeches is just full of kind of poisonous phrases strung together in a nonsensical sequence, basically, which again makes the program far more shallow than it perhaps ought to do if it was going to do this subject justice. Because the situation is that people don't make speeches like that, and if they did, they would be regarded as slightly odd or slightly strange, or you might think that they were an infiltrator who was trying to make the movement look ridiculous. I thought it's disappointing that, in common with lots of programs of this type, there was no attempt on the part of the program makers to explain why the Jewish question is a question at all. If I sort of read you Colin Jordan's speech outside the synagogue, he says, inside these doors, a man, a degenerate, a thief, a snake, a violator of Christian values, preaches our destruction. Inside these doors, a man plots the white man's slavery. Inside these doors, a man spouts lie after lie after lie, and you are expected to walk by without protest as this poison spread. Well, not today. Today we say the Zionist conspiracy is broken. Today the shackles of the global elite will break and the white man will be free. And they all start banging on the door then, shouting, no more Judah, which again is a kind of like a ludicrous phrase, but it's
like they just cut and pasted things together, isn't it? They've cut and pasted things together, which don't really make a lot of sense. And, you know, why would anybody sort of go along with that? Why would anybody be attracted to that? It's the projection, isn't it? They want the viewers to think this is all that it was about. And people are stupid for going along with it. And this is all that nationalism is about today. It's an idiot saying things like that and trying to wind Jews up outside the synagogue. You know, that's the point of it, I think.
Yeah, that's absolutely, yeah. And one other sort of interesting scene was one where there's a character in it called Nancy, who is the wife of this Solly Malinowski character. And at the end of it, she speaks to this chap called Stevie, who is a man of mixed race, whose mother owned the hair salon that Vivian worked in, and at the end of it, this Nancy turns around to Stevie after it's all over, and she says, "At the end of the day, we're all the same, ain't we?" And Stevie turns around to her and says, "No, we're not quite the same, but maybe we're fighting the same fight." Which, that's how that's
ultra corny. Ultra corny, isn't it? Really cheesy.
It's really corny. And then, of course, after all this sort of fighting has finished and the National Socialists have been rounded up and loads of them being carted off to prison, you have this scene where Vivian decides that it's no longer safe for her to carry on living in Britain because of the fact she's been a mole and she's got into the National Socialist movement means she'll be a marked person thereafter. And so she then uses the passport of her cousin, this Rosa Furstenberg, who said to her, "Don't let anybody know you're a Jew." So she uses the passport of this Rosa Furstenberg, which is a Third Reich era passport that originally would have had a photograph of this Rosa Furstenberg in it. But because Vivian's father is this master forger of documents, he's been able to take her photograph out of it, and he's put Vivian's photograph in. So Vivian then leaves the country under the guise of Rosa Furstenberg with a passport emblazoned with a swastika and with a big J printed across the sort of the edge of the picture in the passport. And so it's, there's all that kind of symbolism woven into this as well. And off she goes, and that's pretty much how it ends, really.
Isn't it a bit anti-Semitic to be portraying one of these Jews as a forger? I mean, it's interesting, really. It's probably better than I thought of it. When you were describing it, I did think when you meant it was comic book, it was intended to be comic book, but it does sound really, really cheesy there. When she was talking about don't let anybody know you're a Jew, I think what they're trying to do there is that they're trying to sort of give people reasons for why we have crypto Jews and why Jews pretend not to be Jewish. You see, from their point of view, it would be, because people have a go at us if they know we're Jewish. So that's why we pretend to be Gentiles. And of course, then the Gentiles will say, well, Jews pretend to be Gentiles so that they can weaken the nation and pretend to be a Gentile and say things or do things which are going to weaken their competitors, the Gentiles. And again, that, it just ties in to multiculturalism. That is the cause of all of this. You have to look at these things objectively, I think, and look at it from their point of view as well. And that's really what we're seeing in a program like this. We're seeing what the National Socialist movement appeared to be like to Jews. And the sad thing is, we don't see anything on the television which is showing what it looked like to the National Socialists. It's all one-sided. I'm very glad you went into that, Max, and gave that review of it. Is there anything else you want to add to it? Have you covered everything there, do you think?
No, I think I've covered all that I really wanted to say. Let me just look back over my notes. No, I think I've covered everything that we can usefully draw from that. It's just, I suppose, that the programme was promoted so heavily by the BBC. I was expecting it to be a far more substantial programme. I was expecting the characters to be more believable, obviously less comic book. And I would have thought that sooner or later, we know that there is a disproportionate number of people of Jewish descent working in the media, and obviously this program was produced with a very hefty helping of input from Jews who were involved in the 62 group, etc. And I would have thought that in the interests of good race relations, at some point, one of these programs has got to try to present a balanced program where they acknowledge that yes, there are some reasons why some people have criticisms of multiculturalism, because in reality the criticism that there aren't specific criticisms of Jews. What the issue with regard to multiculturalism is that multiculturalism inevitably provokes and causes ethnic minorities to behave in a way which is whereby they come into conflict eventually with the host community, and also where they are in conflict with each other, because they're in a situation where they then become where they're then in competition for finite resources and for political influence, and that is the failing in this situation. That's something that I would have hoped that at least one ethnic minority organization, or perhaps the Jewish community, would have understood by now, and would have started to produce a more even-handed portrayal of interracial relations.
Yeah, it's like the conflict of interest that arises through multiculturalism. I mean, it's just obvious that there's going to be conflicts of interest between groups. I am surprised they didn't have George Lincoln Rockwell cracking onto Vivian. It does seem as if they wanted to portray Vivian as the really hot chick in the program, because of course she was Jewish. But there we go. I'm sure it won't be the last we see of programs portraying that sort of view, and obviously trying to make the nationalists out to be the bad guys. Well, shall we get into our greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's talk some more about Captain Robert Falcon Scott of the Antarctic. We'll start with a recap. Last episode, we learned how the Discovery was built out of wood rather than steel and loaded with food, gallons of alcohol, a library and a piano. We learned of the danger involved during blizzards of snow and how one man had already died, while another fell asleep and woke up 36 hours later without even frostbite after the snow had covered him over. We'd heard how they could get so exhausted they would just fall inside the tent and crawl into the reindeer skin sleeping bags. Other times they would have the energy to undress, keeping new clothes tight to their bodies during the day so that they didn't freeze. The inside of the tent would get iced up with the condensation from breath, and sweat would turn into ice underneath them while they were sleeping. In the morning, they would emerge one by one, facing the wind, wait for a lull, and do what had to be done, leading to one's clothes filling with snow and a cold, wet bottom for the next few hours. I mean, it's quite horrific living conditions that they were under. They've been there for about a year. And we'll learn today about what happened on some of these reconnaissance missions, and also about the boat that came to see them. So is there anything else that you wanted to add to that, Max? Anything that you wanted to pick up on that we were talking about last time?
Well, the thing that was impressed upon me most last time was the graphic descriptions of the difficulties that the crew had in terms of dealing with the extreme cold. And you've sort of touched on it a bit again with regard to freezing sweat and all this sort of thing. And I on the one hand was thinking just how awful it would be to actually have to live like that, but on the other hand my mind was thinking how sort of comic some of the aspects of it were, with regard to people sleeping three in a sleeping bag, and every time one moved it disturbed the others and all this sort of thing, and having to keep your pairs of socks tucked inside your underwear so that they didn't freeze up and they were kept warm enough and supple enough for you to be able to put the socks on and all that kind of thing. It's just amazing, really, that people, in those days, still there are some people today that have got enough about them to be prepared to sort of undergo the same sort of privations in the interests of science or whatever. It's just very impressive that some people are prepared to do that.
And they would have, obviously, they would have kept the morale up and the sense of humour as well. Well, on September the 17th, 1902, Scott went on a preliminary reconnaissance with Barn and Shackleton. On the second night, a blizzard came up and nearly took their tent away, as they had neglected to pile enough snow around the outside. And before they made it back to the ship, all had suffered frostbite. Many sledging trips took place over the spring and the early summer. On November the 2nd, Scott, Wilson, and Shackleton set forth on their southern journey together with a large supporting party under Barne. This was to be the centrepiece of the expedition, but soon after leaving they were slowed by sticky snow and deep sastrugi, and sastrugi are features formed in the snow by the wind. When you see like great sharp snowdrifts, they look like that's what sastrugi is, and you get great cracks and crevices, they turn into ice, and that's when you get the crevices. A two-day blizzard kept them in their tent, and on the third day Shackleton started to cough. Beyond Minna Bluff they were into the unknown, and already appeared to be lost on the great open plain. At the 79th parallel, photographs were taken, and half of Barne's supporting party turned back. The rest pushed on until November the 15th, at which time the balance of Barne's party took for home. And remember, because we're on the other side of the earth here, it's obviously the summertime in November and December rather than the winter. So Barne's party took off for home, but from the very next day, things began to go wrong. The major problem came with the dogs. Instead of bringing dog biscuit to feed them, dried stockfish had been brought. The stockfish had become tainted as the Discovery sailed through the tropics, and now the dogs wouldn't eat it. From November the 16th onwards, Scott's diary makes sad reading, with the dogs daily losing heart and condition, and the men's hopes of making a heroic journey slowly fading away. There was nothing they could do but to press on as far south as they could, and when the dogs could do no more hauling, they simply would do the hauling themselves. They would have been better off just killing the dogs and depositing the meat as they sledged south, but they went on, somehow hoping that the dogs would revive. This really speaks to, you know, the love that we have for animals, really, and how they become a man's best friend, because that's really what they should have done. But they didn't. On November the 25th, the party became the first to cross the 80th parallel, beyond which all maps were blank. And we have a quote here. "It has always been our ambition to get inside that white space, and now we are there, so the space can no longer be a blank. This compensates for a lot of trouble." Close quote. Hunger now became a problem with the men, as rations were significantly reduced in order to preserve what little food they had left. "We cannot stop, we cannot go back, and there is no alternative but to harden our hearts and drive," Scott wrote. "Certainly dog driving is the most terrible work one has to face in this sort of business." On December the 5th, Scott wrote, "The events of the day's march are now becoming so dreary and dispiriting that one longs to forget them when we camp. It is an effort even to record them in a diary. Our utmost efforts could not produce more than 3 miles for the whole march." 5 days later, the first dog died. The other dogs pounced on the fallen animal and ate the corpse. After this, the team decided to try and save the best 9 dogs by feeding them the flesh of the others. Wilson volunteered for the job of butchering, as Scott considered the job a moral cowardice of which I am heartily ashamed. The victim was led away, with tail wagging, as the others howled in anticipation of the meal to come. Scott wrote, "We can only keep them on the move by constant shouting. This devolves on me. Stripes and Brownie doing absolutely nothing and vomiting. Poor old Granny pulled till she could pull no longer and lay down in the snow. They put her on a sledge and she soon died. The dogs take away all idea of enjoying the marches." I mean, that's an awful situation that they're in. Mm. I mean, who was it that didn't check that they'd actually brought the dog biscuits? They brought the wrong food instead. Basically, that was the cause of this. And of course, they couldn't go back once they had started.
And I suppose some people think that dogs will eat anything, but dogs won't actually eat anything. As anybody who's kept dogs will know, that dogs sometimes can be a bit picky about what they eat, and certainly wouldn't want to eat something that was rotten.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they would actually eat other dogs. But I guess if they're absolutely starving, they've got to survive. More problems appeared, as Dr. Wilson noted that Shackleton's gums were swollen, the first sign of scurvy. Portions of seal meat were increased, but, quote, "hunger is gripping us very tightly." On December the 20th, Wilson lay awake all night from sheer hunger. And on December the 26th, slow blindness was bothering Wilson's eyes so badly that he finally told Scott. The next day, he hauled his sledge blindfolded, and Scott described to him the mountains that were coming into view. Within sight was a huge peak, which was larger than any mountain they had seen thus far. They estimated its height at 13,000 feet and named it Mount Markham, obviously after the originator of the trip, the guy that got the whole trip together. Scott decided to turn for home on December the 31st, having reached 82 by 17 degrees south. They had travelled 300 miles further south than anyone before them and were only 480 statute miles from the pole. A dog a day was dropping dead or being slaughtered. Bismarck was killed on January the 4th. Boss dropped behind and was never seen again. And when Kidd died, they gave up trying to drive the rest and instead set them free to follow on behind. When they were down to one day's rations, Scott pulled out his telescope and spotted the depot left on the outward march. Meanwhile, Shackleton's scurvy symptoms had reappeared. His throat was congested, his breath short, his gums were red and swollen, and he started to split blood. Now there were only two men to pull the sledges, as Shackleton could only walk beside them in order to avoid too much exertion. Well, yeah, think about that. I mean, he's they've only got two men left to pull the sledges, and he can only walk alongside them. This shows that he was the Scott was the correct guy to lead this mission, because he's one of the only ones that are left that aren't snow blind and hasn't got scurvy and is still able to lead. So it really points to him being the right choice to lead the mission here. And I'd always associated scurvy with something to do with the tropics, not in the Arctic or in the Antarctic, but I guess I think
it's a lack of vitamin C causes it, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I'm not sure maybe why I thought it happened in the tropics, but it's a lack of fruit. So I guess you shouldn't have a lack of fruit in the tropics, should you? But they used to get it on the ships, didn't they? When they were just eating ship's biscuit.
It would be on a ship that's in the middle of the Pacific or the middle of the Atlantic, where there's no access to fruit. Ah. So ships, in order to prevent scurvy, would have had crates of limes and oranges on them. But if the crates of limes and oranges, for whatever reason, had gone mouldy or whatever, then they could be out at sea for 2 or 3 months with no vitamin C, and in a situation where scurvy could set in, irrespective of the latitude that the ship occupied as far as the planet is concerned.
Right, so yeah, it's the same situation, no fresh fruit around. On January the 18th, 1903, Shackleton completely gave out, which forced them to camp for a number of days. And finally, on January 28th, they reached Depot A, only 60 miles from the ship. At length, and at last, we have reached the land of plenty. Close quote. With Shackleton aboard one of the sledges, the team set off the next day and sledged 15 miles. On February 2nd, White Island came into view, and Scott wrote, "We are as near spent as three persons can be." On February 3rd, Skelton and Bonacci came out and greeted them. Soon they were back on the ship with handshakes and congratulations coming from all. They had been gone for 93 days and had covered 960 statute miles. And I guess this would have been one of the situations when the champagne came out, having made it into that blank spot on the map for the first time ever.
Yes.
And then supplies arrived. The Morning, commanded by William Colbeck, had left Littleton on December the 6th, 1902. And on January the 24th, 1903, she made fast with ice anchors to the floe off Hut Point. A party from the Morning delivered bags of mail, and Royds alone had 62 letters and a cake. But all the talk was whether the 8 or 9 miles of ice that penned in the Discovery would break up and be carried out to sea in time for her to return with the Morning to Littleton. Colbeck could not risk leaving any later than the end of February, and by February the 10th, it appeared the Discovery would not break free as new ice was forming. On February the 22nd, they tried blowing holes in the ice with explosives to crack the floes, but this didn't work. By the 25th, Scott accepted the fact that the Morning would have to leave without them or risk being trapped itself. 14 tons of stores were offloaded onto the ice, along with 20 tons of coal, with the crew of the Morning sledging them halfway, at which point they met the Discovery crew, who finished the sledging back to Hut Point. The Morning had one other primary purpose to fulfill: to remove any members of the expedition who wished to return to civilization. 8 men applied to return with the ship, but Scott struggled with how to handle Shackleton. In his diary, he wrote that on board he would have remained a source of anxiety, as he would never have been able to do hard outdoor work. Dr. Koetlitz then put his opinion in writing: Mr. Shackleton's breakdown during the southern sledge journey was undoubtedly, in Dr. Wilson's opinion, due in great part to scurvy taint. I certainly agree with him. He has now practically recovered from it, but referring to your memo as to the duties of an executive officer, I cannot say that he would be fit to undergo hardships and exposure in this climate. And Shackleton went home. So, that's one of the important ones. Yeah, one of the important ones that's gone back, but we do know that he would go back out there and lead his own expedition. There is much controversy over this decision, as rumours were in circulation that Scott had other reasons for sending Shackleton home. Armitage disagreed with Scott's decision, and bitterness towards Scott grew through the years that followed. Before the departure of the Morning, Scott went so far as to suggest that Armitage go home to be with his wife and a child that he had never seen. Armitage was offended and insulted at this, and later wrote, "I had been told that Sir Clements Markham intended to make the expedition a great Royal Navy one only, but all went well with me for the first year. When Scott thought that he had enough experience to go on his own, he had not. Then he endeavoured to rid himself of all the merchant service element. When he, in a most kindly manner, suggested that I should return in the Morning, I absolutely refused. But he never forgave me, as not only did I destroy the Royal Navy idea, but he feared that I would obtain kudos which he desired." It was, in fact, Armitage who never forgave Scott. So this is really the first time that we've heard about this rivalry between the merchant service and the Navy. And this is because Scott has already made it into this white patch on the map, and he wanted Armitage to go back. And Armitage is thinking, well, no, I want to stay because I want to continue, and so that they can say that the Merchant Navy got there as well as the Royal Navy.
Yeah. Amazing that those sort of rivalries existed, but I suppose that. In those days, merchant shipping was a very difficult and arduous business to be in, and probably just as dangerous in some ways as being within the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy perhaps would have been easier than the merchant, the life of a merchant sailor in some respects. And so each would have viewed the other with a certain amount of rivalry, I suppose.
And small things would have been niggling at them as well. If you're living in the company of the same people for a year, small things are probably starting to get to them, which obviously they would try to avoid. Sometimes you just can't help it. Once it was realised that the Morning would sail alone, because the Discovery was stuck in the ice, all the men got busy writing letters. On March the 1st, 1903, there was a farewell party on the Morning, which went on for half the night. The next morning, the Morning set sail. Shackleton shed tears as he watched his friends and shipmates drop out of sight. In his place, Sub-Lieutenant George Mulock, aged 21, transferred to the Discovery. The winter of 1903 set in earlier and was much colder than the year before. Sledging plans were made for the following season, while resentment grew between Scott and Armitage. Royds wanted to go back to Cape Crozier to look for more penguin eggs, while Armitage wanted to go south across the barrier, more or less in Scott's footsteps. Royds wrote, "In my opinion, his sole wish is to beat the captain's record. This the captain wouldn't allow, though not for that reason, by any means." This put Scott in an awkward position. If he refused, Armitage would charge that Scott wanted to keep the furthest south record to himself and not let a subordinate have a go. This raised the question with Scott: are they there to do scientific and discovery work, or are they there to compete for a dash to the South Pole? Scott clearly felt that it was the first named objective. Scott could find no purpose in allowing Armitage to make a dash to the south, as he felt that without dogs, Armitage would be fortunate to get as far as he had, and would only be risking death for himself and his party. It simply made no sense to Scott. Wilson wrote, "The captain worked out the possibilities on paper and showed them to me, and I agreed with him in thinking it was far better to apply all our sledging energies to new work, rather than covering old ground with a chance of doing so little at the end of it. The upshot of it all is that Armitage is off the sledging list for this year altogether, although whether this is due to himself or anyone else, I cannot say." And Armitage's resentment only deepened after that. It's a difficult one, really, but I mean, should they keep going with the risk, or now that they've already been into that white patch? What do you think, Max? Should they have carried on going, allowed them to have a go at it?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult at this sort of distant point historically to make a judgment, I suppose. It's it would be impossible to say, I think, from a modern perspective. You'd have to be there. You know, it's like one of these things that you've got to be there to understand the conditions and to understand the pros and cons of each different option, really.
It was a point of contention for the rest of Armitage's life that he wasn't allowed to keep going, but they had already got there. It is a really difficult one, but they also had all this scientific work to do, and to have somebody just retrace their steps just so that they could go a few miles more is really a waste of manpower. So I think I support Scott on this one. I think he made the right choice. On August 21st, 1903, the rim of the sun appeared for the first time over the horizon. The sledging plans were pinned to the notice board with instructions for everyone to return and be back on board the Discovery by December the 15th, so that all hands could work together to free the ship, if possible, before the return of the morning. So they're all going to be gone for 3 months there. There were to be two major ventures, each with a supporting party to lay depots and then return. Scott was to go west up the Ferrar Glacier as far as he could get. Balm was to explore an inlet south of McMurdo Strait. The first to leave the ship on September the 7th were Royds, Wilson and four men bound for Cape Crozier. The journey was rather uneventful, as eggs and two live chicks were collected. On the trip back to the ship, the temperatures fell to minus 61 Fahrenheit, which resulted in significant frostbite among the men, but they arrived back at the ship without any further hardship. On September 9th, Scott set out with Skelton and four others to lay a depot in preparation for the ascent of the Western Mountains. Meanwhile, Barnes' party was out on the barrier laying a depot southeast of White Island, where the mercury in their thermometer dropped to minus 67.7 Fahrenheit, and then broke. Scott's team left for their main journey on October the 12th. With four sledges hauling 200 pounds per man, they reached New Harbour and dragged their loads up the Ferrar Glacier to a basin at about 4,500 feet. But the runners on the sledges had become damaged to the point that the whole team had to turn around and travel 87 miles all the way back to the ship for repairs. 5 days later, they started out again, and this time they succeeded in struggling to the top of the mountains, where they were then caught in a blizzard that nearly buried them alive. It was the most miserable week of his life, Scott wrote. They spent 22 out of every 24 hours in their sleeping bags for a whole week, only climbing out long enough to get the cooker going and eat a hot meal. On November 14th, they reached the summit at 8,900 feet, where they found themselves on a flat plain, and for the next 2 weeks they sledged due west. A constant icy wind produced raw and bleeding lips, and Lashley wrote, "The wind seems to be very troublesome here." On December 1st, the team turned back, and Scott wrote, "I don't know where we are, but I know we must be a long way to the west. As long as I live, I never want to revisit the summit of Victoria Land." He was disappointed to find that it was just an endless plateau, nearly 9,000 feet above sea level.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite harsh stuff, isn't it? You imagine they've lost the dogs, so they've got to drag the sledges themselves. And then when they get to just at the start of the mission, they discover that the sledge rails are broken, and they've got to take them back. And you've also got to remember that they were supposed to be leaving with the morning, when the morning got there. But the Discovery had got wedged in the ice, and they didn't want to leave the ship. So they stayed with the ship, they've got extra supplies, and they're going to spend another year doing scientific work without dogs, basically.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and how would you get a message back to Britain? You've got to remember, they didn't have radio at this time. You know, they couldn't message base and say, we're going to need more dogs along with the supplies. So when the morning arrived, it didn't have dogs with them. They didn't think that they might need a replacement team of huskies to drag the sledges. They just brought them the food and mail.
Yeah, at 9,000 feet, you know, it's mentioned in there, I think that 15,000 feet is normally the point where you the air starts to become really thin, and you start to need to use extra oxygen. But at 9,000 feet, perhaps in those cold conditions, that would have exacerbated their ability to absorb oxygen as well. So there's lots of different things that could have been affecting them and making life more difficult than one might have thought.
Yeah, this is the first time they've really been in these sorts of conditions. It's all completely new for man to be in conditions where it's so cold that the thermometer breaks. And, you know, imagine the wind chill as well. If it's that bad that they had to spend 22 hours inside the tent for a week and they could only go out for 2 hours a day. I mean, it must have been absolutely freezing cold. And they got frostbite as well. They're cooking in the tent. They're actually having to have the cooker in the tent. So, you know, the fumes from that can't have been any good either, unless they had a hole in the top, I should imagine. But if they had a hole in the top, that's going to let the that's going to let the snow in. I guess the heat from the fire would have evaporated the snow if they had a hole in the top of the tent. But they haven't actually mentioned that. Maybe they had proper tents with a metal bit with a flue pipe that was actually going up, but then that's a lot of weight to carry. And all these things you've got to think about. I mean, all we can really say is that this is, you know, these are some really tough guys.
Really tough. Yeah, absolutely.
Really tough. And being the first to actually get to this far south. And when you think of the south, you don't think of the cold either, do you? You think of the warmth, you think of Australia. You don't think of
minus
it like
67
this.
Degrees, 67.768. Yeah. That's cold enough that without special adaption, you probably wouldn't last more than about 10 minutes at that sort of a temperature. And so, you know, the clothing that they were wearing, all the precautions they had to take were in order to keep them alive, and they could die very quickly if any of their equipment started to fail.
Yeah, they're very lucky, really, that they've only lost one man so far, and that was that was falling off a cliff edge and into the sea, along with some of the dogs right back at the beginning. So they've done pretty well just to lose one man so far. Well, I think we'll leave that there for this week, Max. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks with more Real Britannia for you, and of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.